The success of a free Iraq matters to every civilized nation. We thank the 36 nations who have troops on the ground in Iraq and the many others who are helping that young democracy.
The thing I'm struck by, going back to the president's speech, the word is verisimilitude. It isn't true, it doesn't have to be true, but it sure sounds like it could be true. That was what that speech was about, wasn't it?
Well, the fact that we have 36 countries fighting on our side in Iraq must be news to the soldiers over there. I don't know who these people are or how many divisions they have. I mean, all we read about in the papers are American GIs getting killed by IEDs and terrible accidents and all kinds of enemy action over there, usually in the Battle of the Civil War over there. But the idea that we're one of 36 countries fighting the war, I think, is ludicrous. And why the president would throw that out there, I think it only opens them up to ridicule.
Where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? All my defenses dissolve in the air. Where do we go? For the power to bury the dead, see Michael take this blade. The children miss, and the ghost can see. The still invisible day of victory.
So why should the American people listen to him in the first place tonight?
Well, first, Suzanne, you might want to read the poll a little more fully, because it also says that most Americans think the surge is working.
And it says 26% approve of the way he's handling it.
No,
71% disapprove,
well,
and 3% unsure.
I know. But you know what? They also have even higher disapproval rates for Congress. People here are tired of the atmosphere in Washington.
We want to talk
about
the president.
Let's talk
about the president.
Okay, but Suzanne, I'm talking to you about the facts on the ground. The president's going to talk about the surge. And I told you, what you've done is you've selected a popularity number. What I've done is taken something a lot more precise, which is the surge working?
How does the president regain the credibility that he needs to convince the American people that that's true, Tony?
Well, you know what, Suzanne? Your credibility rating, journalist credibility ratings are lower than the president's.
We're not talking about journalists, Tony. We're talking about the president here. How does he turn it around in his 16 months?
First thing you do is you get journalists to read their own polls.
You talk about visiting the White House and how the president was very gracious meeting the members of the Congress and made a presentation. And then in the middle of the presentation, this is how you write about it. The president's eyes became fixed. His voice took on the agitated, rapid tone of someone neither accustomed to nor welcoming interruption. His easy affability was replaced by an almost messianic certainty. Messianic certainty. Those are strong words.
Well, I think the president is a complicated person. As I say in the book, I think he is a decent person, and I like him personally. I think that the president has come to approach the problems we face in very ideological, absolutist terms. And I think that's, to a large degree, characterized how the Republicans who've been controlling Congress have operated over the last several years. And I think that has been a mistake. I think that the American people are historically a non-ideological people. I think when we operate on the basis of common sense and pragmatism, we end up with better outcomes. And I think that part of the reason that the Republican Party has been doing poorly in this election is because people have said, when we look at issues like health care or education or Social Security or foreign policy, it seems as if the president has only one narrow approach and is not taking in the advice and dissenting views that might make for better proposals. And that is something that, I think anybody who's in power for a while can fall victim to. I think this administration has been particularly victimized by that problem.
But when you say messianic certainty, you're suggesting that it's almost as if he believes God wills it.
Well, I don't presume to know what is in the president's heart. I think that one of the president's strengths from a political perspective is that certainty. I think that the problem has been that that certainty has precluded him from looking at issues based on facts as opposed to based on ideology. And I quote in the book one of my favorite stories from the Senate when Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York is in an argument with a colleague on the floor, and the colleague's probably not doing too well in that argument. Pat Moynihan was a pretty smart guy, and at some point the other senator gets frustrated and says, well, you know what, Pat, you're just entitled to your own opinion and I'm entitled to mine. And Moynihan frostily, I'm sure, says, you are entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And I think this administration has not always understood that distinction. And that's part of the reason why we've had problems in Iraq, and that's part of the reason why we've had problems with our budget. There has been an unwillingness to look squarely at the facts in making decisions.
Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Charlie Savage. He writes for the Boston Globe. His new book is called Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. And he's been writing for some time now on the expansion of executive powers under the Bush-Cheney administration. Alberto Gonzalez replaced John Ashcroft as Attorney General. And Gonzalez, of course, recently resigned. Was Gonzalez a believer in the expansion of executive powers? Do you think that that's one of the reasons why he got the job, or was, do you see him as just somebody who the Bush administration could count on to help them in their expansion? I guess the larger question is, where did he fit in the expansion of executive powers?
Well, the answer is sort of both of the two options you just laid out. I don't believe, having looked at his history, that he arrived at the White House with a particular interest in expanding executive power. Nothing in his past as a corporate lawyer in Texas indicates that he had any sort of well-thought-out views on this particular topic. On the other hand, he was very eager to carry out the agenda that was handed to him by his superiors. And one of the things I did discover in the research of this for this book was that in the very first White House counsel's office meeting in January of 2001, right after inauguration, when the new Bush administration legal team was gathering for the first time, he conveyed to them instructions that he had received from the president. He said, you know, in addition to their normal work of just handling the legal work that passes through the White House, they were to have an affirmative agenda of two things that they were to look out for opportunities to implement. One was to move very quickly on getting conservative judicial nominees into the pipeline, since the Republicans had the Senate and the White House now for the first time since 1986. And the other was to seek out and seize aggressively opportunities to protect and expand executive power. Alberto Gonzalez conveyed to the new White House legal team from the president that the president thought that the powers of the office had eroded in the hands of his recent predecessors, and that it was time to fix it up and leave the office stronger than he had found it. Through my subsequent research, and I've come to believe that this was not really George Bush's agenda. This was Vice President Cheney's agenda, stemming from his own 30 years of experience in Washington and his deep experiences following Watergate in Vietnam when he was White House Chief of Staff to President Ford, and all kinds of limits were being imposed on presidential power. And Vice President Cheney himself has spoken publicly about this agenda of expanding executive power, using the very same phrase that that day Alberto Gonzalez conveyed to the new legal team, which is to say, to leave the office stronger than they had found it was a core agenda long before 9/11.
So what do you think Alberto Gonzalez did in his period as Attorney General to help expand executive powers?
Well, to backstep one step, when he was still White House counsel, he was certainly definitely on board for the solicitation and acceptance of these various Office of Legal Counsel memorandum that provided legal cover for such actions as sidestepping the Geneva Conventions and authorizing interrogations that went beyond the limits imposed by law and treaty. He solicited these memos, they were addressed to him, and he accepted them instead of sending them back to be rewritten. After 2004, when Ashcroft leaves and Gonzalez is sent out to become the nation's top law enforcement officer, these trends continue. Obviously, as we know from the U.S. attorney firings and turmoil in the civil rights division and so forth, that the alleged politicization efforts to impose greater political control over the permanent workings of the Justice Department intensified, and there's little evidence that there was any putting of the foot on the brake from then on.
Do you see the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez as being significant in the expansion of executive powers? In other words, does that signify a limit or an end to the expansion?
No, I don't see why that would be. I mean, other people have come and gone now. What's important now, especially as the Bush administration, you know, heads towards its final year, is not what power will President Bush exercise. You know, will he respect laws and treaties or see them as merely advisory and able to be discarded? Will he respond to oversight or just keep things secret? Because the clock is ticking on this administration. What's important is that these various legal theories and tactics for evading checks and balances, for centralizing authority in the White House, have been acted upon for years now, and therefore are no longer theories, but are precedents. They are precedents that future presidents, including liberal Democrat presidents, will be able to cite to unilaterally impose their own agendas on the country and on the world when they want to take an action that might be seemingly prohibited by a law or a treaty, or when they want to keep what they've been doing secret, or when they want to impose greater political control over some aspect of the government bureaucracy, and so forth and so on. And so, you know, the Bush administration could leave office entirely tomorrow, and the agenda will already have been completed, because the strategy here was not, let's increase our own power, and then whatever happens after 2009, you know, who cares? We won't be around. The strategy was, we are going to permanently expand the power of the presidency as an institution for all future presidents to wield. We are going to throw off the restraints that were imposed in the 70s after Watergate and Vietnam. We are going to magnify powers that the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. dubbed the imperial presidency, which had arisen just in the first couple decades of the Cold War, peaked under Nixon, and then were sort of brought under control again after Watergate and Vietnam. So the departure of Alberto Gonzalez is irrelevant to that. What's going to matter is, you know, 10 years from now or 50 years from now, when President whomever, in a situation we cannot now conceive of, wants to do something that the law says he or she can't, they can simply have their Office of Legal Counsel say it's well established that the president can do X, because look, in 2002, the president did X, and therefore it can be done. To understand what has happened to executive power during this administration, you have to look back at Cheney's career. And Cheney himself has said this repeatedly, that all of this agenda is coming out of what he experienced 30 years ago. He got his first government job as a mid-level Nixon administration official, helping Nixon expand the White House power over the bureaucracy at the height of the imperial presidency. And then he himself, Cheney, rose to the heights of executive power very fast at the age of 33 as the White House chief of staff to President Ford after Nixon had resigned. Right at that moment where he was getting his chance to wield the imperial presidency's powers, Congress had awakened. They were passing all kinds of new laws and holding oversight hearings to reestablish the constitutional equilibrium between the executive branch and the other two branches, imposing new checks and balances on how the president could go about his business, what he could do, what he could not do, what information he had to share with the public and with Congress. And to Cheney, inside the executive branch at that era, it felt like a siege. It felt like it was an outrageous situation. These powers were being taken from his hands just as they were his to wield. And he would spend the next 30 years trying to roll back what had happened in the mid-70s, first during his 10 years as a member of Congress, during the Reagan administration's fights with Congress. It's defending the White House against Congress during the Iran-Contra scandal and so forth. And then as Secretary of Defense under the first President Bush, urging him to launch the Gulf War without going to Congress for permission, despite a law that had been passed after Vietnam saying the president always had to consult Congress before launching a major military action such as the Gulf War. And that advice was rejected. But when Cheney becomes vice president in 2001, one of the most experienced vice presidents ever, working with one of the least experienced presidents ever, and then fills the administration in addition with his people who he had worked with the previous 30 years and would be in key positions to shape policymaking and decisions, he is able, finally, to begin working to achieve the goals that were established in the mid-1970s in his mind, which was to put back what had been lost after Nixon fell, to reestablish, although he wouldn't use this word, the imperial presidency.
Now that the show is over, over and we have jointly exercised our constitutional rights, we would like to leave you with one very important thought. Sometime in the future, you may have the opportunity to serve as a juror in a censorship case or a so-called obscenity case. It would be wise to remember that the same people who would stop you from listening to Boards of Canada may be back next year to complain about a book or even a TV program. If you could be told what you can see or read, then it follows that you could be told what to say or think. Defend your constitutionally protected rights. No one else will do it for you. Thank you.
And now, a message from the President of the United States.
Overwhelmingly made the decision to elect me as your 43rd president. I knew the road ahead would be difficult. We have accomplished so much, yet challenges lie ahead. In the last 6 years, we have been able to stop global warming. No one could have predicted the negative results of this. Glaciers that once were melting are now on the attack. As you know, these renegade glaciers have already captured parts of Upper Michigan and Northern Maine, but I assure you, we will not let the glaciers win. Right now, in the second week of May 2006, we are facing perhaps the worst gas crisis in history. We have way too much gasoline. Gas is down to 19 cents a gallon, and the oil companies are hurting. I know that I am partly to blame by insisting that cars run on trash. I am therefore proposing a federal bailout to our oil companies because, hey, if it were the other way around, you know the oil companies would help us. And on a positive note, we worked hard to save welfare, fix Social Security, and, of course, provide the free universal health care we all enjoy today. But all this came at a high cost. As I speak, the gigantic national budget surplus is down to a perilously low $11 trillion. And don't get any ideas. That money is staying in the very successful lockbox. We're not touching it. Of course, we could give economic aid to China or lend money to the Saudis again. But right now, we're already so loved by everyone in the world that American tourists can't even go over to Europe anymore without getting hugged. There are some of you who would like to spend our money on some made-up war. To you, I say, what part of lockbox don't you understand? What if there's a hurricane or a tornado? Unlikely, I know, because of the anti-hurricane and tornado machine I was instrumental in helping to develop. But what if? What if the scientists are right and one of those giant glaciers hits Boston? That's why we have the lockbox. As for immigration, solving that came at a heavy cost, and I personally regret the loss of California. However, the new Mexifornian economy is strong, and El Presidente Schwarzenegger is doing a great job. There have been some setbacks. Unfortunately, the confirmation process for Supreme Court Justice Michael Moore was bitter and divisive. However, I could not be more proud of how the House and Senate pulled together to confirm the nomination of Chief Justice George Clooney. Baseball, our national pastime, still lies under the shadow of steroid accusations. But I have faith in Baseball Commissioner George W. Bush when he says, we will find the steroid users if we have to tap every phone in America. In 2001, when I came into office, our national security was the most important issue. The threat of terrorism was real. Who knew that 6 years later, Afghanistan would be the most popular spring break destination, or that Six Flags Tehran is the fastest growing amusement park in the Middle East. And the scariest thing we Americans have to fear is, live from New York, it's Saturday night.
Before you go, Newsweek magazine reports that Senator Barack Obama has sought you out for your advice on foreign policy. True?
True. I met with Senator Obama twice. I've been around this town a long time, and I know everybody who is running for office. And I make myself available to talk about foreign policy matters and military matters with whoever wishes to chat with me.
Would you ever come back in the government?
I would not rule it out. I'm not at all interested in political life, if you mean elected political life. That is unchanged. But I always keep my eyes open and my ears open to requests for service.
Any endorsements?
Oh, not yet. It's too early.
But you'll support the Republican?
It's too early.
Would you support an independent?
I'm going to support the best person that I can find who will lead this country for the 8 years beginning in January 2009.
Of any party?
The best person I can find.
General Powell, thank you for your views.
On the subject of you being gone forever, I still can't believe it. I can't see it. I should just stop counting days. On the subject of future, wouldn't it be nice to live it open-ended and pretend
Sam's from Indiana. After high school, he enrolled at Purdue. But college wasn't for him back then, so he dropped out and joined the Army. When he was sent to Baghdad in 2003, at the start of the war, he was Sergeant Sam Slavin of the 2nd Armored Cavalry. He didn't know much about the people in Iraq or their religion, but he knew he wanted to help them. And at first, it seemed like they wanted that too. In fact, listening to Sam describe the early days of the invasion, I realized I'd forgotten that scenes like this ever existed.
No, nobody shooting at us. They were just, you know, happy to see us, glad to be there. You know, they bring tea out for us and sit and socialize. We even had one family bake us a cake.
After a few months of that treatment, it's no wonder that when Sam came under fire for the first time outside a power station he was guarding, he was truly surprised.
It just didn't make sense to have somebody right there shooting at us, and I was just like, this is ridiculous. What are you doing? Because you know, I'm going to have to shoot back. And, you know, we did.
As the insurgency got going, so did Sam's piecemeal education in Islam. His unit was stationed in Sadr City, where the cleric Muqtadir al-Sadr was building his own militia. And translators told the soldiers, Iraqis were being urged to, quote, kill the infidels.
And I guess, you know, we were the infidels or whatever, so it seemed like the imams telling the people that, you know, just kind of influenced everybody to go ahead and conduct those actions against us, and we were pretty upset. Just at Islam, because, you know, their leaders were the ones telling them to do that. At least that's what we were told.
Then came the day that changed things for a lot of guys in Sam's unit. On October 9th, 2003, his platoon was out on patrol. On a nearby street, another platoon from the unit drove straight into an ambush. They were lured in by a woman and child, pretending they needed help.
They stopped to help them, and a couple of the privates, you know, saw people running with guns, and just everything let loose, IEDs, RPGs, and rifles and machine guns, and just so many guns going off all at once. And I like it. I never even seen anything like it in a war movie. It was literally a wall of red just moving from left to right and right to left, all these bullets in the crossfire. And, you know, of course we weren't armored. You know, we didn't even have doors on our vehicles. There was nothing we could do. We could have stand there and, you know, traded fire with them all day long, but, you know, just the numbers, you know, there's no way we would have survived. And it was just terrifying. We weren't in the worst part of the whole thing, but it was still the scariest thing I've ever seen, probably ever will see.
Two guys from Sam's unit were killed that night, and the Americans felt betrayed. The ambush was so big that plenty of the locals must have known about it. But no one, not any of the people they'd been trying to help, had warned them. After that, Sam says, he could never really look at Iraqis the same way.
I mean, just from that point, we're just like, you know, we had to just kill all these people, you know, just to be safe. You know, you just, you know, instead of saying hello to them, you tell them that, you know, F you, or just, you know, some sort of insult. You know, we knew plenty of them in their own language there, and had no problems, you know, talking about them or their mothers or whatever, and, you know, whatever. It was a two-way street there. That's, they hated us more and we hated them more. You know, the feeling really was shared throughout our unit. One day I walked in and we had a TV and DVD player set up, and there was this group of privates. You know, they're all great kids, and they were yelling and cheering. I was like, oh, well, what is this, you know? And they kept rewinding part of this movie, and they just keep playing it. And it was from the movie Rules of Engagement, where Samuel Jackson, you know, tells the Marines, you know, waste them, whatever, and all the guys open up on this crowd of Arabs and just, you know, kills everybody in it. You know, and they'd yell and cheer and rewind it and watch it again and just rewind it, because it's what they wanted to do.
And was it what you wanted to do too?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. star is shining, shining on the manger. Yes, shining on the manger. Yes, welcoming a stranger. Glory be to the newborn King.
Tortoise, like some great feather, riding the sword, was mighty proud of the place it's playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt bustling with activities. We can see orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers are probably lining the windows, looking down at the field ahead of them, getting a glimpse of the mooring mast. And these giant flagships standing here, the American Airlines flagships, waiting to rise into all points in the United States when they get the ship moored. There are a number of important persons is on board, and no doubt the new commander, Captain Max Frisch, is thrilled too, for this is his great moment, the first time he's commanded the Hindenburg. On previous flights, he acted as a chief officer under Captain Lehman. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames!
Get it started. It's crazy. It's crazy terrible. Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers are screaming around me. I don't do it. I can't even talk to people. His friends are out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just like a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can hardly breathe and talk and scream. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. I'm sorry.
And now, friends, I want to tell you, I'm back here. I want to tell you that the wreckage is still flaming out there, but I have some very good news for you. I just came from the front of the building where they have set up an emergency station, and they claim that between 25 and 30, that is the estimate, between 25 and 30 are saved out of the wreckage. Now, I have here a total of 39 passengers and 61 crew. That would make an even 100, but they tell me there were about 106 on board, so that makes 35 out of, between 25 and 30 out of 106 so far saved and accounted for, that is, they have been identified.
So he is a tremendous spiritual poet.
Can you help me understand the popularity of Rumi, the 13th century mystical poet?
Yes, I like geniuses. And
Rumi was a genius?
Yeah, he was. I'm going to give you one that I did.
Translated?
Yeah. I don't like it here. I want to go back. According to the old knowers, if you're absent from the one you love even for 1 second, that ruins the whole thing. There must be someone. Just to find one sign of the other world in this town would be helpful. I feel that in Minneapolis. Just to find one sign of the other world in this town would be helpful. You know, the great Chinese Cymer bird got caught in this net. What can I do? I'm only a wren. My desire body don't come strolling over this way. Sit where you are. It's a good place. When you want dessert, you choose something rich. When you choose wine, you look for what's clear and firm. What is the rest? Talking about what is the rest? The rest is television. What is the rest? The rest is mirages and blurry pictures and milk mixed with water. The rest is self-hatred and mocking other people and bombing. So, just be quiet and sit down. The reason is, you're drunk, and this is the edge of the roof. It's a good poem even for the United States right now.
Why?
Look for what's clear and firm. What is the rest? The rest is mirages and blurry pictures and milk mixed with water. That is a way to cheat in the old days. The rest is self-hatred and mocking other people and bombing. So just be quiet and sit down. That'd be a good thing to say to Bush. Just be quiet and sit down. The reason is, you're drunk. And this is the edge of the roof.
Your mature life has been bracketed by two wars, two long wars, Vietnam and Iraq. And you wrote poems against Iraq, and you wrote poems against Vietnam, and both of them went on.
Yeah.
Poetry didn't stop the war.
No, it's never been able to do anything of that sort. It merely speaks to the soul so the soul can remember. So it's quite proper to have all the poems against the war, and it's proper not to be disappointed if nothing changes. Would you like me to read the poem I have against the... This is probably the first poem written against the Iraq War in August of 2002.
This was before the invasion.
Yeah. Tell me why we don't lift our voices these days and cry over what is happening. Have you noticed the plans are made for Iraq and the ice cap is melting? I say to myself, go on, cry. What's the sense of being an adult and having no voice? Cry out. See who will answer. This is call and answer. We will have to call especially loud to reach our angels who are hard of hearing. They are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. I was thinking of Grenada. Remember we invaded Grenada? Why did we do that? We'll have to call especially loud to reach our angels who are hard of hearing. They are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. Have we agreed to so many wars that we can't escape from silence? If we don't lift our voices, we allow others who are ourselves, to rob the house. How come we've listened to the great criers, Neruda, Akhmatova, Thoreau, Frederick Douglass, and now we're silent as sparrows in the little bushes? It's a very bad pun, but I left it in. We are silent as sparrows in the little bushes. Some masters say our life only lasts 7 days. Where are we in the week? Is it Thursday yet? Hurry, cry now. Soon Sunday night will come. And Sunday night came when we bombed Baghdad. Where are we in the week? Is it Thursday yet? Hurry, cry now. Soon Sunday night will come.
Why isn't there more outcry?
If there were a draft there, the outcry would be just as great as it was in the Vietnam War. Many of the people getting killed are the sons of people in northern Minnesota or somewhere who don't have any access to protest. But it was a disastrous choice, like most of the other decisions he made. And
I go back to that acceptance speech you made in 1969 when you accepted the National Book Award, but you gave your $1,000 prize to the resistance against Vietnam. You said, quote, as Americans, we have always, remember, this is 1969. As Americans, we have always wanted the life of feeling without the life of suffering. We long for pure light, constant victory. We've always wanted to avoid suffering, and therefore we are unable to live in the present. Do you think that's still true today?
Yes. So isn't that amazing that it's happening, that the people in Washington are not suffering at all, but the ones who are suffering are those young men who had a bad education and needed to escape somehow from the trap of American life, and so they go there and get their legs and arms blown off.
Garrick, one of the things that fascinates me, we talked about this earlier, is that you were saying that really he changed the way you did stand-up.
Well, I mean, I walked into his class in 85, and I had just started doing stand-up, and to this day influences completely how I operate and prepare as a stand-up. My material is integrated into my body, and I prepared. I then meditate and let it go, let the material go, let my mind be clear, and walk out and see what impulses hit me, which means that I can fail on stage. It means I'm willing to fail because I'm going to be whatever I am in that moment, which I am as I speak to you. So I'm stuttering around looking for the exact way to put this and so forth rather than having it memorized. But it's going to be more human. And then I trust my instinct, and I've done enough preparation for that particular set of comedy that I know what the material is, but I don't know how it's going to come out. And what I've learned over time is half the time it comes out better and half the time it comes out worse, but when it's better, it soars because it's inspired, which I don't take credit for. What I mean is I'm out of the way. I'm not a comedian looking to be liked, to do. There's nothing in my head but.
Or a comedian waiting for that one big joke that you know is going to kill.
Right. Now, I will say that I'm professional enough to know that I have a handful of big jokes that I can throw in when I'm in trouble, which is the same thing we do in life. In life, we know what we've got that we're going to pull out if we're in trouble. We've got our things to go to. And so.
Well, one of the funny things Roy used to say in class is to people, somebody say, well, you know, you could act that moment, because in life, sometimes we're acting. When you show up and you're late, and you know that you're going to be late, and you actually haven't had a problem, you act, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, my car broke down, all the rest of it. We act in life. I mean, we do these kind of like little deceptions sometimes to each other. He said, so it's okay to act those moments, because those moments actually you wouldn't be free and open.
It gets so ultimately confusing as we theorize it, and it's clear in this wonderful documentary about Roy. But you know, I also would cast parts in Larry Sanders. So you know, someone would come in to read a part, and I remember once a woman, an actress, walked in who you wouldn't know. She was reading for two scenes. And she walked in, and as soon as she walked in, she was kind of nervous and weird and fidgety and jumpy. And I already thought, that's exactly right. She sat down in the chair. She was perfect. She was uncomfortable. And then all of a sudden, she started to do the scene with whoever was reading with her. And she thought she had to do it right. And she shifted out of that thing, and she started to do it right. And I stopped her, and I said, listen, when you came in the door, you had it. You don't need to do this other thing you're doing because you're not getting to see you. So let's bring it down and start all over. And we actually worked with her the way I learned from Roy, which is, please, you would be nervous. You should be nervous. You would do whoever you are. I want to see you. You're covering you. Now, the passion that I have in say you're covering you, that's the passion Roy has when he sees an actor, a human being, not presenting themselves at a 100% authentic level. It's practically immoral because we're human spirit, human souls, and he wants to make sure that you're showing that.
Well, you always used to say that, you know, who you are is more interesting than whatever's been written on the page. If you can bring that and then just do the stuff on the page, it's just such a bonus. I mean, if you just show up, if you just show up as a whole person and like do that, you let someone capture that on camera, that's magic.
So if you go off of right what he said just quickly, in Larry Sanders, what had to be really explained and what was the theme of the creative workings of that show was be, actually I'm saying it now, be. I don't care if these words are right. Change the words. I don't care. And one by one, each actor became comfortable knowing, oh, they could just be. And that's why in that show, it's fairly unpredictable because it feels like, I can't tell, are they doing lines? Are they ad-libbing? What's going on? Because they were given permission to be.
See, this brings something to mind from, by the way, it's The Treatment. My guest, Christopher Monger, he's the director of the documentary. Special thanks to Roy London, one of Roy's students, Gary Shandling, he's here too. And watching one of the special features in the Larry Sanders box set when you're interviewing Sharon Stone, it's almost like watching, it's like you're preparing for a scene, the way you guys are sitting and talking about the food and everything before you even get going.
Well, you know, Sharon called me after we taped that interview for the, it's not an interview, it's a visit. I don't know what you call it. That's not supposed to be on. It's not even supposed to be entertaining. It's like, let's get the cameras and just be. And to her credit, she was. So you see, that's real. That's a real conversation. And she was willing to be talking to me. And she called me up and she said, my God, after she saw it, because we didn't edit really. She said, my God, you've caught what Roy has been teaching, which is just to be. And I was nervous because I thought she might react like, oh, I don't really want to be seen this way, which was so open and vulnerable and something was happening. And, that's the great thing about Sharon is, she's ballsy. And so she said, that's great. You just captured in that what Roy's teaching.
I guess I find myself wondering, Gary, because so much about stand-up, what we hear, or when comedians do talk, and you were talking before about the HBO award show where Seinfeld gets the award from Chris Albrecht, and you're there on stage with Chris Rock, with Robert Klein, and you guys are all sitting around talking to Jerry Seinfeld. They all talk about a certain kind of rigidity, and you must have sort of come in, having written comedy for a long time before you did stand-up, with that mindset, and you had to be sort of broken out of that a little bit through him, didn't you?
Yes, that's my biggest challenge in life. My biggest challenge artistically is to work out of control. It takes enormous courage not to be in control of what you're feeling and doing. And so as a stand-up, you know, you're there, you've got the mic, you know, there's a certain control that you automatically have. But to allow your inner life to be out of control so that people can feel and see you living, so that the person on stage is a whole human being, not a stand-up comedian, is my approach. And I think I prepare a little differently than my buddies, and we talked about it on that special. And
again, what I was saying before, you can see the surprise in your face as you're saying some of these things on stage.
Right. I had no idea, but at one point, I, as you can imagine, am an observer. And I learned just, you know, so much from Roy. It's indescribable. It affects everything I do. But the fact is, I think Anderson Cooper said to Seinfeld, what was your first Tonight Show like? And he and Jerry said, well, it was just amazing. And it was so special because it's all special to us to be a comic on the Tonight Show. And he had a great set. We did our sets a month apart. And Jerry said, I think probably before I die, the day I'm dying, I'll probably think back to that stand-up set. And that's how important it was to me. And Anderson Cooper said, Gary? And I said, well, mine went well, and my guess is Johnny Carson, the day he died, thought of my set. Now, what's interesting is I couldn't believe that came out of my mouth, and the voice in my head said to me, "Oh, I notice I'm on tonight. I notice I'm on." Just as a quick observance.
Show notes at lies.com. I'm John Callender. Thanks for listening. 16 more months.
Shirt. treasure I've got. Treasure I've got.